There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hi, folks. Charlie Bazzina here. Join me for my Hunting for Killer show on March 2 at Roomba's Function Centre in Gisborne, just 40 minutes north of Melbourne. I'll be taking you on a unique and fascinating journey, outlining my investigations from discovery of a body to some surprising conclusions. This presentation is not to be missed. Tickets available at trybooking.com, and the ticket price includes a pasta meal and a complimentary glass of wine. Limited seats are available. Hope to see you there.
In my 27 years as a Victorian policewoman, I investigated everything from a stolen bicycle to a stolen life. Policing taught me a lot about human nature, which I explore in my podcasts with a variety of fascinating guests discussing the human side and impact of crime, not only on their lives, but mine as well. My podcasts are not suitable for children and some adults for that matter. If you find yourself affected by my subject matter, please contact Lifeline or any other support service or person that you feel comfortable with. My guests provide their recollection of an event or incident, sharing their thoughts and their emotions, but it's theirs and not everyone will agree with them. I understand that and I hope you do too. Thank you.
He was chased by a police dog up a tree. He fell out of the tree, shot himself in the head with his own firearm. The bullet travelled around the front of his skull and out the other side, and it didn't faze him. He still wanted to fight the dog handler and the dog. So he was that sort of guy.
Cameron Duncan was part of a hand-picked team of Victorian detectives assigned to assist the Special Operations Group in assisting criminals Archie Butterley and Peter Gibb, who, with the aid of Gibb's secret lover, prison guard Heather Parker, escaped from the Melbourne Remand Centre in March 1993. Cameron's knowledge of Butterley and his modus operandi, his MO, was one of the main reasons he'd been handpicked. Butterley despised Cameron and only days before their escape had made a credible death threat to Cameron and his family. So upon Butterley's escape, Cameron's family had to be immediately evacuated to a safe house. Butterley and Gibb were career criminals, having spent much of their life in prison for offences including armed robbery and manslaughter. They weren't brain surgeons, and their escape plan was testament to that. It was doomed from the very beginning, ending with a policeman being shot, stealing that policeman's firearm, a motel being burned down in country Victoria, and a shootout with the police. And the police won, with Gibb and Parker being arrested and Butterley dying in the shootout. It's never been proven how exactly Butterley died, whether by his own hand or maybe Gibb or Parker having some sort of involvement. But, you know, I'm guessing it doesn't really bother Cameron how he actually died. Cameron and his team received bravery commendations for their heroics in this crime, which is a story in itself, and I'll get Cameron to expand on that later. Cameron is very uncomfortable talking to me about his involvement in this crime and wouldn't have agreed to be a guest without me having spoken with his colleagues and receiving their go-ahead. Cameron is very humble and doesn't enjoy or seek the limelight. But through some help from his daughters, who happened to be fans of mine or listen to my podcasts, we've managed to have him agree to be a guest. So thanks, girls. I owe you big time. Cameron's decorated career, it came at a cost, though, in many respects. His best mate, Gary Silk, was murdered along with Gary's colleague, Rodney Miller, in 1998. And Cameron wants him to be acknowledged and remembered for his competency and bravery in so many investigations and arrests, not just for being shot in Cochrane's Road, Moorabbin. Cameron retired a few years ago and he's now enjoying more time than ever with his growing family, something that he missed out on for so long, too long, but he's making up for lost time. So, Cameron, I think I can call you Cam, thank you very much for joining us today. And again, thank those daughters of yours. They've done a good job.
You're welcome, Narelle. It's good to be here.
Yes, it's a pleasure to have you. So, Cam, can we go to the first thing I want to ask you? You were a decorated detective, but you're not really comfortable with that description, I understand. But you've got every reason to stand up and be congratulated and tell the world about your police career, but you choose to let others do that. Well, I've hounded you, I've pestered you, I've bothered you. I might even go as far as saying I've annoyed or harassed you, but I've got you here. How does it feel to be in the hot seat?
It's nice of you to describe me as such, Narelle, but decorated detective, I don't think so. If you think I received a command commendation for one job, and I don't think that makes anyone a decorated detective if you've been one for 15, 18 years or in the police force for 25, 28 years.
Yeah, I'd have to disagree with you, Cameron, because I was in the job for 27 and I never, ever did anything like you did, putting myself in such a dangerous position. And I think that that's what it's about, like the bravery that you showed. You put your own and the community, you put your own bravery, you put your own safety aside for the community in a huge way. And these people that you were capturing, they had shot a policeman. So, I mean, that just takes it to another level, wouldn't you agree?
Yes, yeah, I do. But it unfolded unfolded slowly. It's not something that you say, well, look at that, I'm going to jump into the middle of that. It's you just find yourself after or in a set of circumstances where you just make the next move, and it's not something that you think about. It's not something that you're trying to show bravery or anything like that. It's just there's not really nowhere else to go when you're in those circumstances.
Well, there is, because when you were handpicked for this, you knew that the trio had escaped. You knew how dangerous they were, particularly Butterley, because you'd had previous dealings with him. So you could have said, I mean, yeah, there's probably not a lot of people that would say no, but you could have said, no, this man is, because we'll get to this, but you've said Butterley is the most dangerous man you have ever had dealings with. So you did have a choice. So yeah, I suppose we could go round in circles and we could argue till the cows come home, but I think we have to acknowledge you are a decorated detective, Cameron, and clearly that sits uncomfortably with you, but not everybody gets a bravery award. I mean, really.
Well, gendarme got a commendatory entry. I think a lot of people in the 80s remember a police horse getting a commendation, so, you know, Narelle.
Oh, when you say it like that. What did John Darm, what did he get a, he, I imagine it was a horse, what did he get an award for?
I'm not sure if they still have them, but they used to have commendatory entries in the Gazette every fortnight for people who had done good things, good works, brave things.
Yeah.
And John Darm, the police horse, died. So they gave him accommodatory entry. And I think everyone who got one after that thought, well, yeah, I've been compared to a horse.
Oh, dear me. Oh, you've thrown me. Oh, dear, that is too funny. Oh, God. You know, I remember John Darm from, I reckon he was at the academy. He did something, he was always the first horse, wasn't he, in like any of the police funerals and all that sort of stuff. He was pretty famous. Is he still alive, do you know?
No, I think he passed away. I think he died in the 80s. Yeah. The realm.
Yeah. Oh, dear. Oh, okay, well, let's move on. Tell me what your proudest moment is in policing. Oh, first of all, how many years did you do?
I'd have to look back. I think I got my discharge papers from Christine Nixon. I think there was 28 years on that.
Okay. It's a pretty good effort, I would have thought. And in that 28 years, apart from, let's say, your bravery award, or maybe I shouldn't say that, what is your proudest moment in 28 years of policing?
One thing that myself and two other fellows from the major crime squad did, Kevin Headley and Peter Evans, I've known since we were 16, we were suspended at one point in 1992, charged with some serious offences. And during that time we learned that two young coppers from Doncaster had been charged as well with a minor assault on a drunk they'd locked up, and one of them took his own life. So after we were no longer concerned with the prosecution brief, there wasn't much in that, we decided to get a lunch together of that with, involving that surviving fellow and all the other guys that we knew that were suspended at the time. And then we got together a list of about 20 people, like from the armed robbery squad, drug squad, and suburbs. And we had a big lunch at the Railway Club Hotel in Port Melbourne, and that young fellow from Doncaster was all of a sudden swamped with support. And he went on to beat his charges, of course, and those lunches went on for some years. And so that, I think that was a really good thing.
Mm. Oh, yeah, I've just, you know, there's so many police, let's call it for what it is, police suicides. And particularly of late, I've just learned of one just last week. It's a tough job. And I imagine the shame, well, obviously the shame or the humiliation, embarrassment, whatever it be, of being charged with something. It just gets too much, well, obviously got too much for that young man. But isn't it terrible that a job can send you to that those depths of depression or depths of despair? But what a lovely legacy that you left by having that lunch and celebrating his life, and as you say, supporting his colleagues' welfare. God, what a tough thing. How did his the colleague that survived? I was going to say, but. Do you keep in contact? Do you know how he is these days or how long he kept in the job?
No, I don't. I don't, Narelle. I followed his trial. He went to find himself, obviously. Okay. And I think it was at the county court, and it was a walk-up start for him, as they often are, the strength of these cases, often like show trials. And no, I don't know. I don't know whether he stayed or I don't. I haven't followed any further with him.
Yeah. I think sometimes to remain in contact, some people can And I think, you know, I've been through traumatic things in my career, and there's people that I will always have a connection with and a really strong connection. But when I see them, it really triggers me, and I find that I actually can't see them. So I sort of get that. What about your favourite time in policing, and why was it your favourite time?
Oh, it was all good.
Well, being suspended wasn't good, Ken.
Oh, it wasn't so bad either. It was a year off on full pay with my two best friends at the time.
Yeah.
But they were never going to separate us. That was all right. But, no, I really enjoyed I turned up to Fitzroy Police Station when I was only 19, and that was just a great environment to learn from the tremendous sergeants we had there. It was a different town to how it is today. It was a tough working class town. I really enjoyed that. I was at the BCI Dogs for a while, which was a lot of fun. I went to the my first spot in the CIB was at Flemington, which was really good. That was right over the Wall Street period, and the Flemington crew obviously were involved in Wall Street. The uniform brands were the hardest working bunch of blokes you'd ever meet. It was a lot of fun. But obviously the major crime squad I went to from there was probably the highlight, to work under a boss like Peter Spence, who was a legend, and was some of the funniest characters you'll ever meet. Dave Waters, Charles Dando, these sorts of blokes on good jobs, escapes, extraditions, good inquiries. My crew sergeant was Graham Arthur, who was a very good detective. I still see him. And after that, the prison squad for a bit. And I enjoyed being promoted too to St Kilda uniform, back to basics really, but being able to guide some of the young guys there. Many went on to do bigger and better things. Yeah, so it was all great.
Yeah, you might explain to the listeners, tell us a bit about the BCI Dogs, because they may, I just want to explain, I think most people now will understand, because we talk about the dogs a lot, but they are surveillance police that, you know, watch people and get evidence and sort of spying on them, I suppose. You know, they take videos of them somewhere or take photographs and just sort of follow them to see what they do. But tell us about being with the BCI, because there's a lot of people that won't understand what BCI is.
Yeah, BCI stands for the Bureau of Criminal Intelligence, and they had a number of sections, technical and one tactical, and one was surveillance, and they're called the Dogs. And I was only there for about 18 months, but it was totally different to uniform work and totally different to detective work as well. But you're working for detectives, mostly crime squads, and they've got a target that they're interested in. They want to follow him, gather intelligence or evidence. And so you go out in a team of cars and follow them around and try not to get burnt, try not to get caught by them, try to photograph them and their associates, that sort of thing. It was very exciting.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, I've worked on a couple of jobs where the Dogs have got the evidence that we needed to be able to convict, really, an offender. It is the best feeling, but a lot of times I find that the Dogs just seem to, well, a lot of time is passing time in a car, eating, you know, Maccas and hamburgers and everything, just waiting for somebody to move. It can take forever, but when they move, it's on, isn't it?
Oh, that's right. You go from nothing to 100 miles an hour in a space of 30 seconds. Yeah. But you might, a classic job that you might do at the Dogs is for someone like the major crime squad, where they're looking for an escapee from jail, and they might set you up on his girlfriend or his brother, whatever, and you might just watch them for a week or 2 weeks, and then you might see the offender arrive. And so you communicate that to the detectives, and before you know it, they're doing the intercept right in front of you, or the SOG are doing the intercept right in front of you, and it's the culmination of great planning by the detectives initially and by, I guess, the expertise of the surveillance people.
But it's also exciting stuff, isn't it? Like, oh, I miss those days, Cam. Oh, do you?
Yeah. You watch it on TV and it's never the same, but you just can't ever think about what you've done too.
Oh, yeah. There's something about that adrenaline rush and, oh, gee, I miss it. There's nothing quite like it, is there? Hey, you were talking about working at Flemington with the Flemington crew and, boy, and Wall Street. That was a really volatile time to be in policing, because I joined in 87 and the Flemington crew were, you know, they were hot then. So did you, were you ever involved in any arrests or anything with the Flemington crew?
I had some involvement. I went to one of the last armed robberies they did before Wall Street occurred was at a bank in Flemington. I went to that and they had fired a shot at one of the Flemington CIB vehicles and hit it in the boot. And that was pretty full on. We didn't know who they were at the time. Then Wall Street occurred, and before we knew it, our little office at Flemington was overrun with task force detectives, major crime and armed robbery blokes, and we were just doing raid after raid with those guys. Probably where I got the idea to go to the major crime squad, I think.
Oh, yeah, because, and you were talking about the squads. There's something about the squads. It's just, it takes challenging to a whole new level, because you are dealing with the, like you're saying, you know, you're dealing with people that have shot people, shot at police, and, I mean, it's so rewarding, but, gee, it's challenging. You know, the jobs you get are really, a lot of them are really high profile, and, yeah, it's. I just loved it. Oh, God, talking about it, I tell you, I could go back to it tomorrow. Well, I couldn't. I couldn't jump a little fence these days, let alone a 6 foot one, but I used to be able to.
Well, it's great.
Even in a skirt.
It's great when you're 30, I think, and I'm 61 now. But when you're 30, between, say, 25, 35, it was just ideal. You were at the peak of your physical powers, I guess, and it was just so interesting all unfolding in front of you. You look back on it you watch underworld shows and you say, oh, yes, you know, I saw that, I knew that person. But at the time, it's happening in your future. So it unfolds in front of you, and it just becomes something that you just do every day. And
Second nature. Yeah. So apart from the doomed escape and shootout that we'll talk about shortly, can you share with us another investigation which has stayed with you for whatever reason?
There are other escapes, other, I guess, bigger inquiries, but one is a classic Gary Silk story I'd love to tell you.
Please do.
Mm-hmm. It's just a funny one. He's a real character, Gary, and we're at the prison squad, and he got a file, one of those chief commissioner yellowback files to go out to Pentridge, and he asked me to come with him. And we drove all the way out there. I didn't even know what the job was. We talked about football because that's all he talked about. And we went to the interview room at Pentridge, and in there was Julian Knight, and Gary had this job. And we walked in there, and Gary did his classic Clint Eastwood expressionless face. The insignificant man wanted to shake our hands, and he got a bit disappointed. But Gary asked him what his problem was, and he said, well, the back half of my Saturday newspaper is going missing every weekend, and I've complained to the Attorney General and wanted to investigate it. So Gary looked at him, listened to his story for a little while, and he said to him, well, Mr. Knight, that's not even worth anything. There's no value you can place on the back half of a newspaper. So I tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to send you a bill for two detectives and a police car. And then and we walked out, and I must have broken a couple of ribs walking out just laughing at Gary Hamill. That's just the classic way he used to do stuff.
You can't be serious that Julian Knight would actually lodge a complaint, a formal complaint, about not getting the back half of the Saturday paper, really?
Oh, yeah.
You know, they've said he's a vexatious litigant, but that takes it to a whole new level, doesn't it?
Well, you'd be surprised at the prison squad. You get letters written by prisoners who've got nothing better to do. They're there forever and they complain about all sorts of things. And I would have thought that the minister responsible or the attorney general would just send them back, saying we're not wasting time with this. But no, everyone gets sent to the prison squad or the prison's own investigative section, and they all have to be looked at. It's a waste of everyone's time. But I guess, you know, if they've got a complaint that they're being mistreated or assaulted or something like that, it's got to be looked at.
Oh, of course it does. That's a whole different story, but missing a back part of the
yeah. I was going to mention that at his funeral and apologise to Mr. Comrie, because at the time customer service was the big thing in the job in the mid-90s.
Yeah.
But now I got talked out of reading that out from the at the funeral.
Oh, what a shame. Oh, people would love to hear that story. Well, you've told it now, Cam. So, and we will get to Gary Silk shortly, but I wanted to go back and if you could tell us a bit about Archie Butterley and what type of person he was, because I read somewhere that, and as I said before, you said he was the most dangerous man you'd ever had dealings with, and you'd obviously had your fair share of dealing with dangerous criminals. So what was it about him that made you feel that way?
I'm not sure I was quoted correctly about the most dangerous, but he was certainly very dangerous bloke. We came upon his name. My crew were investigating an aggravated burglary before they happened every second day. And in Doncaster, that was pretty nasty, and there was a lot of money involved. And we had no idea who was responsible. It was a man and a woman, and it turned out to be Archie Butterley and his girlfriend, Marta Cassotti, and they were both Perth criminals who'd come over to do that specific job. And so researching his background, which is all in Perth in Western Australia, he had a shocking reputation over there for a hatred for police, for violent crime, manslaughter, armed robberies, that sort of thing. Mm. And interestingly enough, I never actually met him, because whilst we were investigating him and Marta for the aggravated burglary, he was arrested for something else out in the western suburbs. He, from memory, he went out there to shoot someone. He was chased by a police dog up a tree. He fell out of the tree, shot himself in the head with his own firearm. The bullet travelled around the front of his skull and out the other side, and it didn't faze him. He still wanted to fight the dog handler and the dog. So he was that sort of guy.
Wow. Yeah. Dumbass. Well, you know, I say dumbass, but he managed to, you know, stay out of jail for a little bit of his life, I suppose, but not a lot. Yeah, as I said before in my intro, he was no Rhodes Scholar, was he? Tell me about that moment that you learned that he'd escaped. We'll go back to Peter Gibb and Archie Butterley and Heather Parker escaping from the Melbourne Remand Centre. So how did you feel the moment you learned that he had escaped? Because only days prior, you were made aware that he'd threatened you and your family, and it was no idle threat, was it? It was a serious threat. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, when we were looking at that aggravated burglary in Doncaster, he was on remand at the time, and Marta Cassotti was out, and it was a long investigation that took about 4 months, and we had his phone off at the remand centre, and on one occasion we went to Marta Cassotti's flat in Punt Road and did a search warrant there looking for evidence, and after that was done, she went and visited him. No, sorry, she phoned him and she complained about the search, and she said to Archie that I treated her a bit harshly, which is just a terrible thing to say about someone. But Archie wasn't very happy with me, and he said, oh, Cameron Duncan, I'm going to kill him and I'm going to kill all his family and that sort of thing. I didn't pay much attention to it because he was in jail. We had a laugh about it. But, yeah, he broke out a couple of weeks later, and that changed things a bit.
Oh, yeah.
I'd sent my family down to Phillip Island, and then we worked for that week, next week, to recapture them.
Mm. Which I suppose leads us right into the actual, you know, what happened. So he's threatened you. You've found out about it. Haven't taken it too seriously because, as you say, he's inside. However, he then escapes. So that's a whole new level again. But your family's safe now. They've gone down to Phillip Island. Tell us about, in as much or little detail as you feel comfortable, about that escape and the capture.
Sure. It's 30 years ago this year. So I don't have notes. But I remember...
I don't expect you to have notes, that's all right.
I remember Greg Dowd coming to my place and telling me that what had happened, and we went into town, and Greg got busy putting a bit of a task force together. There was no major crime squad, as you know, who would normally have done that. So it was... And there really wasn't a replacement either, so it was just some guys from the prison squad. Graham Arthur, who knew Archie as well, had been my crew sergeant. He came from the homicide squad. Mick Engle from organised crime, and some fellas from the special response squad, Peter Signorotto. And we just took over an operation room, put up a whiteboard, and started working on the various crime scenes that they'd left behind. And we went to Heather Parker's place to see whether she was involved in the escape or whether she was, in fact, a hostage. That had to be decided pretty early. And then it just unfolded then over the next week.
And what unfolded?
Well, we knew that one of them, probably Archie, was injured because they'd had a bad car accident just half a K from the remand centre where they crashed into a guardrail. They got out of the car and hijacked a passing motorcycle. The motorcycle with them on board travelled along, and they were intercepted by poor old Warren Treloar and his offsider, Sean Plug. And Warren Treloar was shot by Archie because he's so aggressive, and he
hates police, as you said.
Tooled up. Heather left the firearm in the car for him. And then they got away from there and they swapped a vehicle with Heather down in Seaford, and then they headed out east, and we heard that they were treated at the Latrobe Valley Hospital. And that's when we learned of the extent of Archie's injuries, which weren't just a broken ankle, but he had some internal injuries and he was bleeding.
Mm-hmm.
He was using tent.
He'd broken his ankle jumping out of the remand centre, right. Hadn't he? He hadn't started off
well. That's right. But he had worse injuries from the car accident, and he was using tampons to stem the blood flow. So he was not in good shape. And we had some idea then where they were going, in New South Wales or up to the mountains, and then we heard that the pub burnt down at Gaffney's Creek. So we went up there. I was in the car with Graham Arthur, again, the sergeant, and Gary Silk and myself, and we went up, checked the pub out, and sure enough, all the descriptions and from all the people in the hotel led us to believe it was them. We stayed the night in the Jamison Hotel, and in the morning a fisherman discovered the wanted vehicle, which was a Pajero parked near the river and covered in brush. So we attended there, and around about that time Archie opened up with his weapon, and the SOG were there too at the same time, but the three of us, there were others, but the three of us I couldn't remember, Gary, Graham Arthur and myself, we had shotguns, and we basically hid behind gum trees because this machine gun, it was a CAR-15, which is a shortened version of an M16. It was very loud.
Goodness.
Sounded like it was 3 feet away. You couldn't see anything in the bush. It was probably about 20 feet away. And it was just basically hiding behind this tree until the SOG engaged him. And that went on for about, I guess, 20 minutes or so. There was a lot of rounds being fired. It was very loud, and we were either hiding behind the tree or trying to dig a trench in the ground. And then I don't want to get ahead of myself here, Narelle. You can pull me up if you want.
No. Keep going. So you're behind the tree, and Archie is firing off rounds and rounds. The SOGs are shooting. Yep. Are you shooting, or are you're letting the SOG shoot?
I wasn't so much letting them shoot, but.
That's how ridiculous.
I couldn't see. I would have fired my shotgun in his direction, but it was just within a foot in front of your face. It was just bush. It must have been like fighting in Vietnam or something. You couldn't see. You could hear him, but you couldn't see the thing. And but we did see
God,
because there was a river between us and Archie, and we're conscious of the river to our left, and we saw, I think it might have been Peter Signorotta who first saw Gibb and Parker in the river. So it just so happened to be Graham and myself who went into the river to arrest them because they were trying to sneak out of the scene.
Yeah, but you wouldn't have known at that stage that, like, there was a huge probability that they would have been armed.
That's right. We didn't know.
I mean, there's that in itself, Cam, like, I know.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like, a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot.
we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
You say that you do it automatically, and a lot of people, like, that is just brave to the I can't think of anything braver. Like, and these are not just, you know, they've stolen a little old lady's purse. You know, these people are murderers, and they've been prepared to murder a policeman like Warren Treloar. And you just, I mean, you say it very casually, oh, we, you know, went to the river to arrest him, but boy, that is, that's incredibly brave. But anyway, I know, again, we could argue about that and discuss that till the cows come home. Okay, so you go to the river, you see them, and you and Graham Arthur go to arrest them in the river. Did you have a bit of a fight in the river?
No, they had about three or four shotguns pointed at them and various other weapons from the detectives who were there, not just the two of us. Mm. So if Gibb had been armed, or Heather, or it would have been a different result, I'm sure, but they weren't. As soon as Heather saw us, she jumped onto Peter Gibb to shield him from us. And so at that point we thought, well, they're pretty safe. So we walked out and grabbed them and dragged them to the riverbank. And but, of course, the shooting was still going on between the SOG behind us and Archie in front of us, so we had to hold those two offenders down in the ground. And we were down in the ground, and it was a glorious sight to see a helicopter come up behind us, F-490, and another half a dozen guys in black rappel out of the helicopter and run straight past us. One of them stopped to truss Heather up in front of me, which is good because I wasn't able to. And then we waited for it all to finish, which took about another half hour or so. And then Graham and I, obviously, we had our respective prisoners. We organised a transport to the Jamison Police Station. I stayed with Heather. Graham had Gibb. We took him into the Jamison Police Station separately, I think. It's a very small police station. I put Heather in a change room. It's actually a closet, broom closet, with a policewoman to get her out of her gear and into an FSL suit. You know, they made a movie about that, and they had me undressing her in front of 8 or 10 detectives in the muster room, which I thought was pretty ordinary. Plus the acting.
I wouldn't be very happy with that.
No, I wasn't. Yeah. No, I wasn't happy with the choice of actor either. I thought, you know, Matt Damon or someone could have done a better job for me.
Who was the actor?
I don't know.
Some weedy-looking nerd.
I didn't even look like a detective. You know, we prided ourselves on our appearance back then.
You did.
You were short.
You used to command quite an audience, the guys from the major crime or prisons or whatever, your detectives. Oh, yeah, that'd be harrowing to have somebody, some weedy little nerd.
And he wasn't wearing the short sleeve white shirt or the black tie. with the garlic stains on it. That just wasn't realistic at all. No wonder it didn't want to lower you. Then we loaded him on the helicopter with some SOG blokes for companionship, and we flew to Melbourne. And that was interesting too, because all the way I'm flying back to Melbourne, I'm covered in sweat and water and stuff, and I'm planning this interview in my head, as you do, you know, when you arrest someone.
Yeah.
And it was a complete waste of time. I should have just enjoyed the flight.
Why was it a complete waste of time?
When we got back to the homicide squad, fresh detectives are going to do the interview, obviously, but I didn't think of that. So I just gave someone a briefing about what had occurred. I had a couple of cans of VB and was sent off to see the psychologist. And that was it for me.
Yeah, thanks for that, Cameron. Off you go, and we'll go from here. Yeah,
well, that's the best way to do it, though. I mean, you wouldn't want to do the interview yourself.
Oh, wouldn't you? I would.
No, I was too tired.
Yeah, well, that's good point. Can we go back a little bit? Tell us a little bit about Heather. What was like? You're sort of looking after her. You're in charge of her. What was her demeanour like?
Other people would describe her as a thing. She was awful.
Yes.
She didn't want to stay on the ground. She didn't understand that she might get shot. She lifted her head up. She kept looking at us and abusing us. And suggesting we were going to take her up the road and shoot her because the police had been shot and all this stuff. And I remember in the back of the car, she said one thing to me. She said, "You know, we've had a lot of fun this week." I thought, what an inappropriate thing to say. But, she had me.
We've had a lot of fun this week.
No remorse, not one little bit of remorse. The movies painted her out to be this poor thing that was taken advantage of by a criminal, Peter Gibb, just for the escape purposes, but it was a lot more than that. She was not a very nice person, and she wasn't just taken advantage of. I mean, they stayed together. When she was released from prison, he picked her up in a limousine. They stayed together and had two children. So she was just an inappropriate person to be a prison guard.
You wonder how she ever got through the system, although I have spoken to prison guards before on my podcast, and I've learned that they have an 8-week training program, 8 weeks to be dealing with the type of people that they are. It seems very, very inappropriate.
Yeah, most of them, in my experience, being at the prison squad where you went to prisons daily, they were really good people and they knew their...
Mm.
They knew their job. It's a job I wouldn't do. It was depressing enough just being at the prison squad and having to go to prisons most days, but they obviously did their whole shifts there and weren't paid enough for it.
No. You know, funny you say that about going to prisons, and I've only been to prisons a couple of times to interview somebody, and I found them so depressing. I hated going. I felt obviously also very vulnerable, a little bit frightened, you know, because you're walking, like you've got a couple of guards with you, but, you know, walking through to get from A to B or whatever. But it made me feel so sad. Oh, they're like, and I know there's people in prisons that need to be there, but they're like caged animals. Oh, I hated it. So I get what you mean about hating to go to prisons. And like you say, probably nearly every day because you're with the prison squad.
Yeah, I think we went to every prison in the state for various things, complaints, some investigations into the prison guards themselves. Since they built all the new prisons and privatised them, there's nowhere near as much trouble as there used to be, which is is a good thing. People don't escape anymore. They used to escape every few months. So it's a much better system now.
Going back to Heather, you're right about the media portrayed her as this vulnerable woman that had, you know, fallen head over heels with this criminal. But from what you're saying, she was not. She probably was vulnerable in a way, but yeah, she wasn't a nice person. I would have always thought, without you having told me that, I would have thought that not this poor woman, but that she'd been manipulated and I don't know, targeted, I suppose, by Gibbon. In a way, she probably was, but. As you say, like to say those sort of things to you and, you know, what a fun week it's been. Like, that's fun.
Yeah. Yeah, she was not a class act, Heather. I mean, even when they were living together years later, she was charged with a serious assault on a woman, put her in hospital for a week because she suspected Peter Gibb had been in a relationship with her. So, you know, she was no better than the people that she guarded.
Gee. With all of this, did you ever feel like walking away after that investigation? And I suppose I'm pretty sure that you've experienced your fair share of tragedy and trauma in the job, which like we did in those days, we just buried how we felt and just carried on from one job to the next. You go back to the office, like you say, you know, you go back, here you go and see the psych, and then the next day you're probably back at the prison squad or major crime doing whatever, you know, onto the next job. I suppose emotionally speaking, were there aspects of this investigation which affected you and which, I don't know, maybe you didn't want to acknowledge or that maybe manifested itself later on in your career?
Well, not at the time. It was all pretty exciting, and yeah, I guess you had a lot of follow up to do. You had to appear at the Camille hearing and the trial and the inquest into Butley's death, those sorts of things. So it was a lot of work to do, and there was also a lot of support from the people that you were working with. Everyone was of a like mind. All the people on that whole floor, the 11th floor at St Kilda Road, it was the armed robbery squad and the major crime. And everyone was always supportive of each other. There was...
You really banded together.
Yeah, that was just... It wasn't a planned thing. That's just the way things went. Yeah, so I didn't consider leaving over that. I did leave the prison squad after a bit because it was a bit depressing. I'd never chosen to go there or sent there, but I did choose to go to Pran CIB for a few years. I thought that would be totally different to, say, Flemington CIB because it was a different town. You know, it's got Chapel Street and all those good places to go to. I moved on without any problems from there.
Oh, okay. So years later, in 1998, your best mate Gary Silk, and you've spoken about him a lot in this podcast, you obviously worked with him a lot, but he was your best mate and he was murdered whilst on duty. I suppose there's many police who reach a point in their career where they just realise they can't or don't want to continue. Did you feel like that walk? Did you ever feel like walking away after Gary's murder?
No. Again, there was so much pulling together of all the people at St Kilda, St Kilda CIB, and all the guys who knew him from the crime department, and we got to meet his brothers, Peter and Ian, and his parents, and multiple functions and remembrance services and those sorts of things. You just got swept up in that as well. I guess these things do build up, the various critical incidents, not just that major one, but you know, even the smaller ones, when you're in uniform, you might go to a SIDS death or a suicide. You certainly go to a lot of them in the CIB. Rape victims, they all build up, and I guess by the time you 50, it does.
Yeah.
Well, I've since learned that it does accumulate, and I've got people close to me who don't understand that, I don't think. But yeah, it does. I think it happens to everybody, no matter who you think you are.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think you're right, Cam. I think there's only so much that you can deal with, and as you get older, I don't think you cope emotionally as well, because, as you say, it is a build up, and it gets to the point where you think you're going mad.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I've had a bit of that. My family will tell you that.
Yeah, haven't we all?
It's really good, because I mean, people sometimes laugh at the concept of camaraderie, and I think that police departments all around the world have been trying to break that thing down, because they see it as a lead into corruption. But that sort of camaraderie keeps everybody sane. Days, especially because those same comrades talk about those things now, whereas they didn't talk about them before. So I can have lunch now with 10 guys from all sorts of different officers, St Kilda sergeants or a bloke from the Robbers or the Majors, and they're happy to talk about, oh, they drink too much, or they take this medication now, but in a laughing way.
Yeah.
Everyone seems to support each other, and not deliberately, it's just the way things we've all moved along and got more mature.
But I think the important point there is that at least you're talking about it, whether you're laughing about it or, I don't know, having a tear about it, but at least you're talking about it and you're not suppressing it or, I don't know, avoiding it or not talking about it. I think that's got to be a good thing. And do you find, are you good at talking about it with your mates?
Yeah, I am. My family, wife is still in the job. She's got six months to go. We all talk about it when it needs to be spoken about, and no one is looked down upon because they might have had an issue, or they're taking an antidepressant or anything like that. And in fact, now people are cutting back how much they drink compared to how much we used to drink 30 years ago. So that's everyone's looking after themselves, I think, these days, or people of my age, that is.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more. I think you start to realise there's no shame in, well, I say no shame. Isn't it funny? I'm fine with telling people about my PTSD and everything that happened, but you know what? I still feel a little bit ashamed, or I don't quite know what the word is, that I take medication, because I always prided myself in, I don't take medication for anything. And then I have to take medication for my mental health, and I found that I still feel a little bit ashamed. Isn't that terrible? Like, we take a pill for a headache or a sore toe or something, but I think there's a lot of other people like me, why do we feel so almost defeated that I have to take a pill to feel better? But it's been my saviour. I fought it for years not to take medication.
Well, it's not just coppers. It's people in the community, the uptake of antidepressants and those sorts of medications has increased for everybody. It's not just for us.
Yeah, you're right. So when you decided to retire, was there a specific reason or incident where you thought, I'm done, I can't do this anymore?
No, I didn't feel like I was done. I would have been happy to keep keep going, but I didn't think I was going to get any further promotion-wise. And
did you want a promotion?
I wouldn't have minded, but wasn't to be.
Okay, yep.
But at the same time, my family circumstances were that I had two young boys and my wife was starting out as a detective, and to give her the opportunity to do that, the best way was for me to be at home, because there was one shift where we both worked on an Easter Monday, and there was no, you couldn't offload the children to anyone. The crèche wasn't open. You couldn't get the day off. It was just, sometimes it's impossible. On that occasion, I sent an email to Christine Nixon because she encouraged that at the time. Mm-hmm. And I said, what do I do in these circumstances? And her reply was, good luck with that. Yeah,
no.
You know, I think, I don't know what she meant by that, but I think that from then on I was like, oh, well, I'll take this opportunity to look after the boys. And that was one of the best 10 years of my life, raising two young boys. My wife was down around a lot, but I'd take them to kindergarten and do all those sorts of things. It was great.
Yeah. Yeah. How long ago did you retire?
2005.
Oh, right. For some reason, I thought it was only in the last couple of years.
No.
Oh, I take my hat off to you, Cam. I, you know, for giving your wife an opportunity to experience some of the great experiences that you had, and to look after two boys, you know, like you completely turned your roles around. How good, and look at the at what that has given you.
It's been great. That's been really good.
Wow. It's only recently, and can you take us back with the situation with Peter Gibb, Archie Butley, and Heather Parker? It's only recently that you actually received a bravery award for your, what I can only describe as heroics, on that day. Why and what took so long, and what did the award mean to you?
I'm not 100% sure on why it took so long. I was only a senior D at the time, so I'm not privy to all the politics, but I can only assume that this task force was hastily put together. We didn't really have a structure. We didn't have an officer. And generally, I guess in those circumstances, an officer would be the one that would push any recognition forward.
And, yes, and they would. You're right. They'd write the report, you know, good work performed by blah, blah, blah.
That obviously didn't happen, and that really wasn't any big deal at the time. But later, my understanding is that when Graham Arthur retired, he put in a report. He was a superintendent. He put in a report to ask why that hadn't occurred, and a job was given to Greg Bowd, inspector at the fraud squad, and he looked into it, and he discovered that even Warren Treloar, and he hadn't been recognised properly. He got a chief commissioner certificate. He had that upgraded to a Victorian Star, or the Police Star Award. Other people in the community, the prison guard that followed in the chase vehicle, the taxi driver, all these people were then recognised as well. So it wasn't just us.
Okay.
Yeah, it was a big effort by Greg, and he had to address the honours and awards committee and come up with proper reasons why these things should be done, and it was eventually done. So I'm quite happy with it.
And that took 30, well, you just said it's 30 years ago this week or something, did
yeah,
you?
Yeah, 6 months ago we got an award.
Okay.
But it took 30 years, and I don't think it was because the department would be ignoring something. They just weren't aware of it. And they became aware of it when Greg did his report, and it went through the honours and awards, and they're quite specific on what they determine is right or wrong. And they determined that we would get, and this is the whole crew, not just Graham and I, there was seven or eight people who got the same award, including Gary Silk posthumously.
Wow. And what actually was the award, Ken?
Well, I'd never heard of it before, but they call it a command commendation. So it was a commendation from the Assistant Commissioner of Crime, it's the Hill, from Crime Command. So it was an award from Crime Command to detectives who were there.
Okay. I'm not taking it away from anybody, but I would have thought that that would have been a bravery award by the government, not just by within Victoria Police, or have I got that wrong?
I don't know either.
It was determined
by the Honours and Awards Committee that was the appropriate award, and I'm happy with that.
Okay. Yeah, fair enough. And my last question in relation to that was, and what does that award mean to you?
Well, I was well out of the job, but it was an opportunity to take my children and some of my family to the new headquarters, which I'd never been in, very flash. And particularly my daughters, who were only born in the 90s, and my sons who were born in the 2000s, they were able to, and they never seen me work, of course, and they were able to come along and be part of the big production and photographed and all that sort of stuff. So I think they got something out of it, and I got something out of it because they did.
Yeah, of course. They just obviously saw what, how brave their dad had been and what he'd done. I think it's recognition. Yeah, that's lovely that you got so much out of it, but also for the kids. How are you finding retirement? Oh, well, actually, no, that's a silly question. I shouldn't say a silly question, but you've been retired now for a long time, so.
No, retirement's good. I'm just waiting for my wife to finish up the last 6 months at Frankston CIB. Yeah, Alan Benzetta. Yeah. And then we might be able to do some travelling like everybody else is doing.
Yeah. Yeah, you deserve it, Cam, you and your wife. Look, I've got to say thank you. Thanks for keeping us all safe for all those years that you did. I'd also like to acknowledge your family who have obviously been your rock. They've helped you through some pretty tough times. But also, they've obviously had their moments with their dad and husband being a policeman, even though they probably they wouldn't remember it. But you've obviously would you have missed some fairly significant family milestones? I imagine you would have.
Yeah, some, but I think.
In your 28 years.
But I think everyone in the job does, uniform as well, everybody does. You work public holidays, and I think I did a couple of Christmas days and some New Year's days.
Oh, yeah. And look, it wouldn't have been easy for him, but I just do want to acknowledge your family and we appreciate the fact that you and your colleagues and I suppose the police in general put the safety of the community before their own, and thank goodness that's been formally recognised. I just hope you feel very proud of your career and what you've achieved. And thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Norrell. If I could, I'd like to make a shout out to the uniform members who attended the Cochrane's Road scene.
Oh, yes. Tell us about Gary Silk. You said that you don't believe that he's really been acknowledged and remembered for what a great copper he was. Tell us about him.
Yeah, well, everybody knew him, thought he was a great guy and a really good friend. And we travelled overseas a few times together and a load of funny stories there. Gary's full of funny stories. But I just think of that incident in Cochrane's Road. He was a very confident operator, Gary, very smart, switched on. Yep. And I think that coward Robert's just got the jump on him. And ever since then, he's only sort of portrayed in the media as a victim when he was a very good and very brave and very good detective at St Kilda CIB. But also I was going to say that I didn't go to that scene. I was working that night at St Kilda, but I didn't go to that scene. The uniform members who went, and there must have been 20 of them, they must have arrived at the worst possible scene that anyone in the police force could possibly imagine.
You're right.
And they did a red-hot job. And what bothers me is that they were never celebrated for it. In fact, they got the opposite. They were vilified by some and held up in court as liars, put on the front page of the paper as liars. I understand it's the legal system. They have to question these people and that sort of thing. But I don't remember the department ever coming out and saying, well, actually, these people did a really good job. And I went to both trials. I heard all the evidence. It was such important evidence. With someone's dying, the evidence they give has to be so well preserved and presented, and they did all that. And yet the department might not have been able to say anything during the trials, but they certainly could have after. And I think some of them aren't too happy about their treatment, and I don't blame them.
I'm sure there would be, and I don't know, but I'm sure there would have been police that attended that scene or had involvement in that scene that were never able to return to policing or just couldn't do it after what they experienced with that incident or with that investigation. In fact, I know of a couple that left policing. So, those ones that went to that scene, you're right, I cannot imagine. I remember when Wall Street happened, the thought of that scene and the police that attended after that, I just can't imagine the grief and the trauma. Oh, my goodness.
Well, of course you go through that, but then you get kicked in the backside afterwards for a great job that you did. And that's what's wrong about police work sometimes. The better you do, the more people you catch, the more criticism you get. And there really ought to be a different system.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's, you know, we could all go and hide in an office somewhere and never get in any trouble and earn the same money. But
Yeah, that's right. And so you said that Gary was a, I didn't know him, but you said that he was a great investigator. He just had that, did he just have that? Some people are just born with it, aren't they? They just seem to be able to, they fall over crooks. You know, they just have that, oh, I don't know what it is, an attraction, a connection. They just know where the crooks are, know how to treat them, talk to them. You know, I've only come across, I reckon, one or two investigators that I felt were that good.
Well, he was very intelligent and he had an understanding of the law, an understanding of people, and he did some good jobs on his own, but they get forgotten, understandably so, because he was such a famous victim. But no, he wasn't just a good guy, and lots of people will say that. He's very popular, but he was also a good operator, and it's always a shame. But it's a shame when people aren't recognised for other things than just being a victim.
In fact, his brother has gone on to become a great advocate, hasn't he? Ian Silk, what does he do now? I've forgotten, but I know he's a great advocate now for police, for mental health, isn't it? He's done a lot.
Yeah, well, he was he ran Australian Super, a very high profile position. I think he now works at Crown Casino on the board. So he's He's a very high-profile businessman, a great fellow. His brother Peter's a great fellow. Carmel Miller has done a lot in the public sector too.
Has she ever? Mm.
Yeah, she's worked for the parole board.
Yeah, she has, and she's also a great victim advocate.
That's right, yes.
Was she on Victims of Crime? I think she was on the board or something, but, yeah, you're right, she's gone on to become celebrated in her own right, recognised.
Yep, an amazingly strong woman, and I'm not close to Carmel at all. I've only met her a few times, but she's an amazingly strong woman.
Yeah. Well, I suppose I'd just like to finish that with saying that, as you say, for all those police that did go to that scene that were so affected, you know, you're not forgotten, and I hope that you're being looked after, and I hope that you've managed to, you know, you can never put that stuff behind you, but you can try and put it aside, I suppose. And, yeah, it's tough stuff, but to all those police that went, we don't forget you.
And one final plug, Narelle, if I could, the Police Veterans Victoria.
Absolutely.
One of the only organisations that look after, probably the only organisation that looks after veterans, and it's all privately run, privately funded.
Mm.
Labor government promised $800,000 publicly and then reneged.
Yeah.
Mr. Andrews. They do a wonderful job, and the Police Association, I've always been a big supporter of the association, and I hope all new members think the same.
Yeah, you're right. I suppose what we're saying there is the support is there. Sometimes you don't realise, but there is a lot of support, particularly, as you say, through PVV, the Police Veterans Victoria. But the Police Association, wow, they do an amazing job as well. So, the support's there, use it.
Definitely.
Yeah. Okay, Cam. Any more plugs?
No.
No, I think we've run out, have we?
No, that's great. Look, thank you again. Thanks very much, Cam. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, and for me too. Thanks, Nora.
Thank you. As you've probably noticed, we've moved to a new platform called Acast. I think that's the right expression, I've got no idea. And my previous reviews haven't transferred over. I need reviews. Could you do me a favour and put up a review? And thank you so much for your support and patronage. With your help, I can give you that little bit extra. Thanks.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time.
That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.